It's the Weekly News Roundup on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Let's start this week with news from Riverhead. The Riverhead School District is being sued because allegedly its high school principal sexually assaulted an 18-year-old student. It's alleged that Principal Charles Regan sent explicit text messages and photos to 18-year-old Anastasia Stepone, and that this went on for approximately 4 months or so. Stepone says the assault took place in Regan's office.
He held the back of my neck and brought me closer. And when everything was over, I got out of there as fast as I could.
Let's bring in Joe Workmeister, who's an editor, and Kate Nalipinski, who's a staff writer at the Times Review Media Group. Welcome both. Hi, Joe. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for coming on today. Joe, what's the story here?
Yeah, it's obviously a very complicated story and very in-depth story and a very shocking story for sure. You know, this, I guess, really unfolded last week when the school district sent out a statement basically on its website saying that the high school principal was being administratively reassigned, and there wasn't much detail to it. And so obviously, you know, the rumors started flying right away, and then on Monday, everything kind of unfolded where we got a press release basically from a lawyer saying these allegations that you had just mentioned, and that there was going to be a press conference in his office, and the victim herself would be there. And so, you know, naturally, that's kind of an unusual step. You know, for us as reporters, we're not necessarily used to seeing something like that unfold in that way. So, you know, everything kind of unfolded pretty fast Monday, and the story has since kind of taken on its own life as this as we try to unravel what happened here with this relationship between a high school principal and the student who was 18 years old.
Kate, the principal is alleged to have sent these text messages for, is it 4 months?
Yeah, well, apparently they were communicating, allegedly, they were communicating since January, and then it kind of escalated since March, and it got to this point, this April 30th, where she was allegedly sexually assaulted in his office, and she was claiming that they made out for about a minute, as she had mentioned, and then she got out of there as quickly as she could.
During that time, during those months, was anyone aware of what was going on?
So she claimed that her friends were not aware of the situation until her spring break, and then how they reacted when she told her, she said they were shocked. No one was entirely aware of the situation, from what I understand, until that day, that April 30th, when she told her friend after the incident had happened in his office, and then her friend told the teacher. The teacher came to her. The teacher came to Dr. Regan and said, you know, had warned him that, he was in trouble.
Has anyone been able to get any comments from Mr. Regan?
Mr. Regan has not responded to any comments. We've attempted to reach out to him several times.
Joe,
yeah, I haven't seen anything from him yet in any of the in any news coverage, and any attempts we've made have been unsuccessful so far.
Joe, what's been the reaction in the community?
You know, it's definitely a little bit of a mixed reaction. Taken us a little bit by surprise. You know, there's definitely has been a faction of the community that's sort of views this as, well, she was 18, she knew what she was doing, and you know, I don't want to say necessarily blaming her, but you know, and to a certain degree, you know, putting some blame on her for sort of not taking responsibility for her side of this. And you know, I think it's always important to remember that in this scenario, it's the person in power, the principal, whose responsibility it is to, you know, be the one that stands up for what's right and doesn't go down this inappropriate path. And so I think part of that reaction from the community is when when people see the lawsuit and they see that $10 million figure, the people kind of lose their minds when they see those numbers and think, well, okay, now this girl's just going to get rich, and they kind of have a negative outlook toward it from mm-hmm. that angle. But obviously there are a lot of other people who are just obviously outraged and disgusted, and I'm sure there's a lot of concern out there too from parents who just want to make sure that they can send their kids to school and know that their kids are going to be safe.
Mm. And Kate, she is seeking $10 million from whom and for what?
So from what I understand is she's trying to get the $10 million from the district because she was sexually assaulted by Dr. Regan. And one of the things, this is kind of backtracking a little bit, but one of the things, just before we go further into this, I want to mention that in Article 23B of the New York State Education Law, a child is defined as anyone who is under the age of 21. So Anastasia is 18. She's turning 19 next month. So according to state education law, this is a case of child sexual abuse, under the education law. And I think that the community is kind of, at least some people in the community are disregarding that.
Hmm. Have you heard any comments? And Joe, maybe you could answer this. Any comments from the police, the Riverhead Police, Suffolk County DA?
Yeah. So we, we reached out to Riverhead Police, back when he was first reassigned, just to kind of try to see if there was any investigation on their part. And so the police did confirm that there had been a report filed. And, at the time, we didn't know specifically related to what. And then so once this news once this news broke, we reached back out to the police again, and we were able to get comment from the police chief, who said not much, basically, that they're investigating. There was a lot of evidence to go through, and, as of now, no charges have been filed. One of the things that did come out of the press conference, one of the girl's parents did mention that she had a conversation with a detective who essentially, from that conversation, made it sound like there wasn't going to be enough evidence to press charges. Whether that changes now, obviously we're waiting to see what comes from that. As far as the Suffolk County DA, if they're getting involved, we haven't heard specifically yet. I did reach out to them, haven't heard back anything specific. I wouldn't be shocked if the DA saw this case and thought, it would be something they would want to investigate on their end for sure. We don't have any confirmation on any details of that yet, but definitely we'll keep an eye on that.
Kate, what was the tone and the mood of the press conference?
Yeah, well, first of all, I was there with my other editor, Grant Parpin, and he we were there first. But by the time it reached 12:30, I believe there wasn't really standing room, essentially they were putting up these poster boards with these alleged text messages, and one quite a few actually very graphic text messages and images, and from what I got, I could really sense some tension. Anastasia was visibly anxious when she came into the room, she was struggling as she kind of spoke and as she began to tell her story. And following her story, the attorney John Jay, he was quite angry, and he was quite frustrated, understandably so.
Joe, I'm sure that the kids in the school, they must be in shock over this. So all of a sudden, I mean, just the news and now the center of this media attention.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure it must have been, I can't really even imagine what these last few days just kind of going around in classes must have been like. I'm sure obviously everyone's kind of talking about it, and, we're not entirely sure how or if at all teachers have addressed this with students, or what kind of steps maybe the district has taken to address this directly with students. We haven't heard anything specific, and you know, the district obviously is not too forthcoming with information regarding this. But I think obviously a lot of shock from students, and who you don't expect something like this to happen. And, you know, especially when you're in school, it seems like something that always happens somewhere else, but obviously never where you are. So.
Kate, we have 45 seconds left. What takes place now? What's the next step?
Well, literally the next step is they're holding a Board of Education meeting on Tuesday. And I know that for sure that there are going to be parents there that are speaking up to the administration that are frustrated. And, you know, there are a lot of avenues for concern from parents and other people in the community, you know. And I think that the district has to listen.
Kate Nalepinski, is it Nalepinski or Nalepinski?
Nalepinski.
I got it right.
My long Polish last name, yeah.
I got it right the first time, so I'm very happy about that. I just wanted to make sure. Kate Nalepinski is a staff writer. Joe Werkmeister is an editor at the Times Review Media Group. Joe, Kate, thank you very much. I'm sure you'll be working on this right through the weekend. We'll check in with you soon.
All right. Thanks so
much. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's the full story on WSHU. It's the weekly news roundup. That's what was going on in Riverhead. When we come back, we're going to check in with Davis Donovan, Ken Dixon, Ebong Udama. We're going to find out what's been taking place up in Hartford. Stay with us. We'll be right back. It's the weekly news roundup, and it's the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. We're going to switch gears a little bit now, and we have three reporters in studio with us. Sometimes they're on the phone. We got everybody in house today. Ebong Udama, to my right. You could see it right there. He's WSHU's chief political reporter. Oh, wait, it's not TV. Ken Dixon is with Hearst Connecticut Media, reporter, columnist, and Davis Donovan from WSHU News. And you also hear his great reports all year and sometimes specials on The Full Story, which I always welcome. It's good to see everybody.
Good to be here.
Hi, Davis. We're going to do three segments with Davis to start us off. Because we did a show just the other day. We did it about measles and vaccines, and we're probably going to do one in the near future also. But we're going to start it off because, Davis, you have a bit of an update on that.
I actually just got this a few minutes ago, so I'm still looking over it. But so last week, the state of Connecticut put out the school-by-school data.
Mm-hmm.
Who's been vaccinated? MMR, right? Measles, mumps, rubella.
Exactly.
So who's been vaccinated? And they said 108 schools. At 108 schools, there's a certain number of vaccinations you need to have. And if you're below that, you're at risk of an outbreak. They said 108 schools were below that number. Some of the data, I was told by the state that some of the data, that the data had come from school nurses. They were still kind of going through it all. Some of it looks like it got a little bit messed up. You might have remembered reading last week that the top school, the most unvaccinated school, the one with the most exemptions, was Reading Elementary School.
Mm-hmm.
That appears to not be true. 40%, they said, of students at Reading were unvaccinated. That would be...
Which set off alarm bells.
Yeah, to say the least. 40% would have blown every other school out of the water. I called, as soon as I saw that, and just jaw dropped, called the superintendent. He said, oh, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. So we just got what appears to be the correct data, and it looks like there's still quite a few schools, still more than 100 schools, where they're beyond the threshold of what's called herd immunity.
Mm-hmm.
If too many students aren't vaccinated, they could have a measles outbreak. And obviously, we've been hearing a lot about that nationwide. Recently, there have only been about half a dozen cases here in Connecticut, but 700 or so cases nationwide.
So obviously, many people are upset. Many parents are upset. And there has been talk about somehow revoking what some people use to not get vaccines, which is religious exemptions.
Right. Well, you can get a religious exemption or you can get a medical exemption. And a medical exemption is maybe you have some kind of condition. Vaccines could be harmful. Religious exemptions, we actually saw that the number, if you look at only private schools, that would include a lot of schools that might be religious affiliated. The number of vaccinations is much lower and the number of exemptions is much higher. And some lawmakers have been talking about getting rid of the religious exemption. Matt Ritter, who is the majority leader in the House of Representatives, said we need to have a conversation about it. Our Attorney General William Tong said the state is well within its right to do that. There's actually other states. West Virginia, no religious exemption. California, no religious exemption. So there is precedent for these states who said, no, we're not going to have that risk. Tong said, you know, the Supreme Court said more than 100 years ago, the state clearly has the right to do this. It's any state's authority to take steps to protect public health and safety. And the power is very broad. That's what Tong said.
We also had a show just the other week, and this ties in perfectly with some of your reporting that you're going to tell us about. It was about Purdue Pharma, based out of Stanford. Obviously, they are the makers, if you listen to this program, of OxyContin, which many people blame for the opioid epidemic in this country. One of the owners, well, the owner of the Purdue Pharma is the Sackler family. Richard Sackler is one of those family members. How does he fit into this story?
So the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma are being sued a lot, thousands of entities, including the state of Connecticut, the state of Massachusetts, the state of New York are suing Purdue Pharma. Purdue Pharma has talked about doing this sort of universal settlement. Connecticut, at least, is saying no. William Tong wants this to go to trial. But I talked to William Tong about this earlier this week because he released as part of this court case, some emails. Sackler was pretty blunt in some of them. They're back and forth with an unnamed.
Once again, this is an email from Richard Sackler.
Right, this is from Richard Sackler, and Richard Sackler says at one point, in a back and forth with an unnamed colleague about people dealing with drug addiction. He says, and I'm going to quote from some of these emails, abusers aren't victims, they're the victimizers. The person he's emailing with then says, and again, quote here, give me a break lest I throw up. The whole thing is a sham, and if people die because they abuse it, then good riddance. Sackler responds to that, unfortunately, when I'm ambushed by 60 Minutes, I can't easily get this concept across. Now, if you're reading into that, this concept being the whole thing is a sham and people die because they abuse it because good riddance. That's what Tong says. Tong's reaction to this was, I'll play a little bit of what Tong had to say.
It just shows the opposite of compassion and empathy, but really the sort of dark heart that motivated their profiteering off of this crisis and human suffering. In the criminal law, we refer sometimes to people as having a depraved indifference for human life, and that's what these emails show. We have Richard Sackler not showing humanity or empathy or compassion, but complaining about how he's treated.
Dr. Sackler said in a statement that Purdue Pharma released, he said he apologized for using insensitive language that doesn't reflect what he actually did. He said that these emails were written two decades ago after reading news reports about drugstore robberies.
Mm. And I want to mention that, as you said, Connecticut is one of the leaders in the lawsuits, but the lawsuits are being consolidated, if you will, in federal court in Cleveland. And it's estimated by some that maybe within the next year or so that this will all be resolved. Mm-hmm. And along the lines, I've been told, of the tobacco settlement. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to see about that. One other thing before we let you get away. Connecticut state slogan.
Right. No longer revolutionary.
No longer revolutionary. That slogan is no longer revolutionary.
I've been told we're phasing it out, so you might still see it pop up on some older merchandise from time to time. If you might remember, I think it was back in about 2012, you saw some commercials. The state launched an ad campaign.
There's a revolutionary idea. Get away to Connecticut, the one state where you can slow down the pace and rev up the excitement. All in one tank of gas. Get more ideas at ctvisit.com.
So we are 7 years past that now. The state has seen its budget for tourism cut year after year after year. Big cuts. This year, Lamont says they're going to get more in the budget. One of the things that he said he's going to do is try to reopen those welcome centers. You know, you see the welcome centers on I-95, you see the closed signs.
They're always closed, especially late at night when you need them.
Right. And he says he's going to reopen them. He also says he wants to have a contest to come up with a new state slogan.
A revolutionary slogan? Oh, okay. We're getting in trouble here. And how soon will this new slogan be in effect? Anybody know?
Well, we don't really know. They're still ironing out how they're going to come up with it. One idea they've had is maybe have a contest with middle school students.
Ah.
One was maybe a social media campaign. So they're tossing out ideas right now.
Or they could just ask some reporters on the full story, and I'm sure we can come up with something. Speaking of reporters on the full story, thank you, Davis. I appreciate all of that. Ken Dixon is with us from Hearst, Connecticut Media. Ebong Udama. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Ken, you've been doing the haul up to Hartford. You and Ebong both, and the sessions have been long. They've been tiring. What was the big story the past week?
Can I say first that the Still Revolutionary contest arouses my depraved indifference?
You don't have a slogan in your back pocket that you're ready to give to the state of Connecticut?
Still revolting.
Still revolting. Very nice.
What was the question? Sorry, I'm still got a little sleep deprivation from the
other night. The sleep deprivation. You were there, and it went on all night in terms of the minimum wage, right?
Yeah, it was super interesting. There were 8 Republican amendments, attempts to kill it, attempts to, at some point, they were just playing with Democrats' heads. There were some, as it would happen, you know, over a 14-hour debate, there was frayed emotions and nerves.
For those who don't know the story, some Connecticut legislators want to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Well, the governor, too.
The governor also.
You know, one of the issues was how many years it was going to be. Then there was a compromise. The person who brought it out is this iron woman named Robin Porter, a representative from New Haven, a single mother who raised 2 kids on 2 or 3 jobs. She ended up giving up an attempt to raise the wages for bartenders and restaurant servers. They're remaining the same at like 8.25 and 6.20 something or other. Another bone of contention was in the out years after 2023 that raises will go up automatically based on the National Employee Compensation Index.
And so it'll for everyone except those who you had mentioned, it will go by, if it passes completely in the Senate and the governor signs it, it'll go, in 2023, it'll go to $15 an hour, and then after that, go up in increments.
Yes.
Okay. Ebong?
No, it's not quite. It goes up by increments to $15.
Well,
to
there,
years.
But I'm saying once it gets to 2023, even after that, it'll go up according to that index.
4-year phase in it. It came out of committee 3 years.
And then after that, it will be automatic.
And then it moves up slightly.
Thanks for explaining that better than I did, Ebong.
Ebong, does it look like it'll pass in the Senate?
That's what they believe, Senator Kushner says she's going to fight for it and she's going to get it through. And as a matter of fact, Speaker Arasimowitz said right after the vote that he's very confident that it will get passed in the Senate and it will get to the governor's desk and he'll sign it into law and we'll have a minimum wage increase.
All right.
You mean you and me, Ebong?
Well, you're gonna need that because tolls may be coming on the road, so you may need some more money to pay for these things. Where does that stand now, Ken?
The governor's been pulling people into his office all week, Democrats one at a time, asking them what they're interested in exchange for their vote, which means that he's finally learning how a bill becomes a law.
And he did have an event today where he He says he's got the bill and it's ready to go and it's ready for a vote.
What does that mean, though? What bill? What's in it?
Well, he says,
okay,
he
now
says,
this, well, okay. this is when we need video because Evan just spread his hands because no one knows.
He's got a list of gantry locations in his hand. He said
he has 50 gantries. It's going to be 4 highways, and that's the extent of the details.
That's all we know.
But he's got a bill. It's ready to go.
But this must be driving you as a reporter, and Ken, you as a reporter. It's not driving you crazy? I mean, it's so vague.
It's coming to us. We're like little spiders in the web. You know, it'll show up in the web, you know, and we'll get to dissect it and tear off its little wings and stuff.
But, well, now that they have the minimum wage done, almost. There's nothing... We've got 3 weeks to go to the end of the session. June 5th is
yeah, midnight June 5th. 5th.
And nothing on the agenda has actually been passed yet.
House members have been told to get ready to talk about family medical leave next week, vaccinations, no less.
Mm.
I'll believe that when I see it too, because that's 14 hours here, 14 hours there, you know, they'll get a few bills passed.
It seems like there's an awful lot to do with just a very short time to go. Why are they spinning their wheels?
Well, the way Lamont explained it today, he says that he's been at the Capitol for 115 days and he's realized that lawmakers try to avoid taking votes. So it's anything to avoid a vote. Anything that's controversial can wait. And he's trying to figure out now how to get them together and get them to actually take some votes.
I think this goes back to what Ken was talking about the other week, that it's time to take the training wheels off. This is how legislation actually gets done.
Well, yes, it's that year after the election, and they still have 900 bills out there, and the lawmakers want their little private, you know, so they can say they accomplished something, and the bigger stuff is kind of waiting. You know, they keep saying they're working on it. You know, the budget, they've kind of just started the budget. The marijuana bill is... got way too many moving parts and no one
give me
champion.
A second from that. I want to do that in the next segment because that's huge. But Abong, from what I was reading the other day, and you're with the governor a lot, it looks like now he's trying to compromise, if you will, with the Republicans on the tolls.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
He had 100,000 signatures, a petition with 100,000 signatures delivered to him from the no tolls folks yesterday. And he says that's all well and good, but they haven't come up with an alternative. And if it's to borrow more, which is the Republican alternative, that's he's not going with that. So that's off the table. So basically any type of increased borrowing to pay for infrastructure development, he's not going to consider. And he says that's the only other alternative that has been presented to him so far.
We've been reporting today that, or today's paper, that he's willing to give a little on the short-term borrowing side, a few hundred million, possibly, to A, get more votes, B, kind of maybe deflect some of the Republican campaign against him, because this thing wasn't going to pay anything, you know, for 4 years. So,
yeah, so
short-term borrowing. Yeah,
there's before the tolls kick in, the fund is depleting really fast. So there has to be some bridge to get to when the tolls kick in and we start getting the toll revenue.
So that's
is that
where
a highway reference.
So that's where he's saying, you know what, maybe we can borrow another few hundred million to do whatever improvements, or at least maybe not improvements, but at least to make sure the fixes stay in for the next 4 years before the tolls get going in 2023.
I think the big lift here is to get enough votes to pass the tolls. And the way it looks right now is... that no matter how much borrowing he wants to do, as long as he wants tolls, he's not going to get Republican votes. I think that's the bottom line on this.
Ebong Udama, Ken Dixon is with us, and Davis Donovan was with us, but now he's going to be gone for this next segment. Thanks again, Davis. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We are talking about the news today. It's the Weekly News Roundup. It's the full story on WSHU. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. It's the full story on WSHU, and it's the Weekly News Roundup. Let's bring in a first-time guest to the program. Chris Hoffman is a reporter with Connecticut Health iTeam. It's a nonprofit. They cover stories about health and safety, and you can find the stories on their website. And if you go to our Twitter page now, Full Story WSHU, you can get all the information about them. Chris, welcome. It's good to have you on the air with us.
Hi, Ron. Thanks for having me on.
There's a lot going on in Hartford, obviously. A lot of it has to do with making the business climate better. Anyone who has ever run a small business or is a freelancer, as many journalists are, they know this well. It costs a fortune to get insurance. So there's a bill to create a state-administered public health option for small businesses. Tell us a little bit more about it. How do you define a small business?
Bill, it's defined as 50 employees or fewer. And by the way, it also includes nonprofits. They would also be able to access this. So what the bill would do, there's actually a number of bills that are out there. There's one in the Senate, there's one in the House, but essentially, they're essentially the same. And what they would do is create a public option for businesses of that size starting in 2020. There's also talk of, there's also some discussion of perhaps extending this to individuals in 2021, but really the focus right now is on starting off with small businesses.
I just want to clarify, so 50 or less, if I have my own business, if I run it out of my home, out of my basement, would I qualify?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Kevin Lembo is the state controller. He's been a guest on this program, and if passed, his office would run this program, is that correct?
That's correct. Well, they would administer it. They would, however, hire somebody to come in and really do the nuts and bolts of it. So the big insurance companies would have the opportunity to really bid on that work.
What are the odds that this is going to pass this legislative session?
That's a good question. People I spoke to, specifically Kevin Lembo and Sean Scanlon, he's the co-chair of the Insurance and Real Estate Committee. He's a very strong backer of this bill. They feel that it has the votes. We have to see if and when it gets to the floor. We're getting into the last 2-3 weeks of the session, and things can get pretty crazy up there. Another wild card in all this is exactly where the governor is on it. He has said that he is in favor of a public option, this type of a public option, but he has yet to indicate his position on this bill. And both Kevin and Marty Looney have told me, Marty being the president pro tem of the Senate, that the governor does have some concerns about it.
Chris, will this cost the state any money? Obviously, the governor is trying to close a big deficit. Is this another program that could possibly cost the state money?
It is going to have an administrative cost, and there was some money set aside for that, as well as for a study. Beyond that, the comptroller is saying that it should be self-funded, but that is an issue that the opponents of this bill have raised. They have suggested that it could end up, that it could get into a situation where it runs in the red and the state has to make up the difference. And they are pointing actually to a program that was created, a somewhat similar program that was created that is allowing municipalities to essentially piggyback onto the state's insurance. That program has cost more than was anticipated. However, there was actually some testimony at a hearing last week at which the Office of Fiscal Analysis said that no money had been transferred yet. and that the comptroller, and the comptroller has said the same thing, that he believes that he's going to be able to adjust rates and essentially make up for this difference on an ongoing basis. He said essentially the same thing about this program. He has warned that there's going to be some bumps in the road, or there could very well be some bumps in the road in terms of cost, because, as he put it, there's a lot of pent-up, conceivably a lot of pent-up demand. People haven't had insurance for a while. They have conditions. They need to be dealt with. But again, he's saying he believes that rates can be adjusted so that this is not a year-to-year drain on the taxpayer.
Mm. Chris, who's against it?
Really, it's two groups are really leading the charge. CBIA, the Connecticut Business and Industry Association, is very strongly against it. They've been lobbying very hard to defeat it. The Association of Connecticut Health Plans has also, which is essentially the health insurers, they're also lobbying very strongly against it.
Why is this flying under the radar? I haven't heard anyone talking about this.
I think it's really because there's so many other things going on. I don't think that that's, I don't see anything, maybe it's too strong a word, but nefarious about that. I just think that there's so many huge issues out there in this session. You have a budget crisis, tolls, a whole bunch of other things, whether or not we're going to have a tax increase. All of these things, I think, just have kind of dominated the session, and there hasn't been enough air in the room, really, for this to get the kind of airing that it might in another session.
Chris, one last question, if I can. Where does it stand in the legislative process now?
Well, it was voted out of appropriations late last week. It was actually kind of interesting because the Republicans used a rather unusual parliamentary maneuver to try to kill it right then and there, and they were not successful. And then we're just really going to have to wait and see. Well, let me add that that means it's ready to go to the floor. That's a decision of leadership. Certainly Marty Looney, the leader in the Democratic leader in the Senate, and the Speaker of the House have both indicated that they support this measure. So I think there's it's more likely than not that it's going to get to the floor, but you really never know what's going to happen up there. We'll have to wait and see.
Chris Hoffman reports for Connecticut Health iTeam. Thanks, Chris. We'll check in with you soon.
Thank you, Ron.
It's the full story on WSHU. It's the weekly news roundup. Abang Udama is here. Ken Dixon from Hearst Connecticut Media. And Ken, before we get back to the subject of what's going on in Hartford, I just need to ask you your take on a situation out of Bridgeport. A Hearst reporter, as your headline puts it, was detained by Bridgeport cops while covering protests. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Well, I would like to describe it as she was assaulted and then arrested. The fact that they didn't press charges on her doesn't matter at all. And in fact, she could have been anybody on the sidewalk with a cell phone taking video of this police action in response to the anniversary of the shooting death by a cop of a 15-year-old kid in a stolen car 2 years ago. It was the second anniversary. And there was a 2015 law that allows people to sue the cities and police departments that violate the right to take video of police actions.
The reporter was there at what time and when?
That's a good question. Early evening, the editors got a call around 9 o'clock that she was at the police headquarters.
Was she arrested?
That once they got her there and they took her belongings, I think somebody finally figured out that she's the woman who has for the last 2 years been reporting about the Bridgeport police, and she probably knows every cop personally, and this one missed the boat.
And I should mention, I keep saying she, and I meant no offense, Tara O'Neill is the reporter.
Yeah, Tara O'Neill.
Where is Tara now?
Well, I was just down in the Bridgeport newsroom. She works a later shift, and she's involved in the story, so of course she's not going to be reporting it. I'm doing a little a piece of it for the Saturday newspaper, looking at the state law, and it, which sprang out of a New Haven nightclub case in which people took video of a cop assaulting somebody outside a nightclub.
Before we get back to Hartford, one last question on this. Any reaction from the Bridgeport Police Department? Have they issued a statement? Have they said anything to you?
Not to me personally. the mayor had some statement last night, but, you know, as we say, the fish stinks from the head, Ron.
This is the Weekly News Roundup on The Full Story on WSHU. Ken Dixon is with Hearst Connecticut Media. Ebong Udama is WSHU's chief political reporter. Ebong, still a number of issues that have to be decided in just the next few weeks at the state capitol. One of them having to do, and Ken was talking about it in the last segment, with marijuana. Some have said the legalization efforts are at a... They put the odds at 50-50. What would stop it right now from being legalized?
Is that a question?
Yes.
There is
a complicated question.
Well, before I get into marijuana, I just want to say that, you know, I had a run-in with the Bridgeport Police years ago when I worked with the Post, and I got arrested covering an event. It was a Lambiance, a building collapse in Bridgeport. And it seems that not much has changed in the department over all those years. So talking about marijuana, like everything else, there's a lot of opposition. And we have, it's hard to tell if we can overcome all the opposition to this. And with marijuana, unlike some of the other issues, this is bipartisan. There's bipartisan opposition to this. And so we will see if it will make it. I don't know. Maybe Ken has a better take on this, but right now it's hard to tell. There are very many moving parts involved. And one of the issues that had happened before, which is, you know, which had built up some opposition, was the fact that people's records would be expunged automatically.
For an ounce and a half or less possession, and you'd need like a judge to sign off on a police report. It was getting kind of esoteric. Maybe the silver lining behind the grassy knoll here is that the Finance Committee's budget includes $60 million for marijuana. And all the bills are still alive. It's just that nobody's really taking the bull by the horns and pushing for it.
And Ken, I forget if it was your column the other day, it may have been Dan Haar's or Emily Munson's counting votes, and I think the number is around 10 short right now.
Yeah, that was Dan and Emily working on that, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, and Caitlin, too. Caitlin Krasselt, too.
Caitlin Krasselt. Ebong, paid family medical leave, where does that stand? Status quo?
Basically, it did get a committee vote. They voted it out of committee, I believe.
I think the House has been told to prepare for a debate on it next week.
Next week, okay.
Next week is it's coming up. So, like we were saying before, a lot's coming up in the next 2-3 weeks.
Well, yes, this is crunch time. I mean, the next 3 weeks, they're going to have late night sessions and to try and get this out. How much of it they'll be able to do is yet to be seen. There's a lot of stuff that's, like Ken was saying, still alive. But, you know, there are only so many days in which you can deal with this stuff before the end of the session on the 5th of June.
You gents have been covering the Capitol for years, and I know there may be some listeners right now who are saying, this is crazy. What are they wait till the last minute? Because it's like a kid studying, you know, being given assignments and over vacation, and they wait till the very last day to say, okay, I've got to read this book. I've got to write these essays. Why do they wait till the very last few weeks to get everything done?
It's the calendar. They've got 27 committees, and they've got floating deadlines starting in late March. Finance and Approps was the first week in May, which was only a week ago. and they've got this huge buildup of bills. And at this time of year, the power's with the Republicans. I mean, that's one of the reasons why it was a 14-hour debate on minimum wage. And they can. I saw like an hour and a half debate on a bill that would require pedestrians to make a hand signal when they're crossing at a crosswalk to make sure they don't get run over by a car. And that was hilarious. The power's in the minority to stall stuff, and there'll be hundreds of bills dying at midnight on the 5th.
I honestly thought you were just making this up. There was a bill, so that way, and let me understand, if I'm going to cross the street, I would have to make a signal, so that way they would know that I'm attempting to cross the street.
Yeah, well, it's a good way not to get hit by a car, too, look at the way people drive.
But they want that to be a law. Okay. I don't know what to say to that. I'm at a loss.
Well, you know what's interesting is that they had time to debate it.
Right. And that answers the question, why does this take so long?
Well, it was like filling in space before some other debate also. It's like it's starting to pour over me. It could have been before the debate on the minimum wage Wednesday.
I know that one of the gun bills, they were writing the bill on the floor as they were about to vote.
Oh, yeah. I think it was before the gun bill. Thank you.
It was the bit about if
you lock it in, if you have a lockable glove compartment in your car, in the Porsche, Ebon.
Yeah. Can I lock my gun in the glove compartment and that will be a safe lock?
And that's a safe lock.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We have 1 minute left. We can get into this more next time we talk, but teacher pensions, I'm assuming that's also on the docket for the next week or two as to whether or not municipalities will pick up anywhere from 5 to 25%.
There's a little bit of a technical issue there because it didn't appear in the appropriate bill. They said they had some technical problem. I don't know whether that has been resolved. They said that had to be resolved. I don't know if you know any.
There was a miscommunication was the term, the way it was written, it was like you could argue it was a message to the governor, but the chairman of the APROPE said that it's definitely in the mix and that should get some outrage among the municipalities here in the waning days of the legislature. But you know, of course, they've got as much time as they need for the budget because 2 years ago it went till October, right?
So it's you guys are going to have an interesting few weeks coming up. I'm sure I'll see you when I see you if that happens.
Just look for the bags under my eyes.
just be careful driving late at night.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Ken Dixon, Hearst Connecticut Media, Ebon Udama. Ebon is WSHU's chief political reporter. Thank you both, as always. It's great to see you. My thanks also to Davis Donovan, who was here a little bit earlier today. Chris Hoffman, who's a new addition to our program, and we look forward to having Chris back on the air also. And I want to thank Joe Workmeister, editor, and Kate Nalipinski, staff writer at the Times Review Media Group, for being on with us at the very beginning of the program from Riverhead. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan, our news director. I hope everyone has a wonderful weekend. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.